him back when he was first brought before Brogan. In confusion, Will looks up at Mr. Dorian, fear fluttering through him. The ringmaster stares down at him calmly and gives an almost imperceptible shake of his head. Will knows he could shout out for help, and the Mountie would come. But he doesn't. He trusts Mr. Dorian. There must be a reason for his wanting silence.
"Ah, Mr. Dorian," says the Mountie. "I saw your performance our first night out. Marvelous."
"Thank you, Lieutenant," says Mr. Dorian. "We're looking forward to performing for you again in a few nights."
"And who is this fellow here?"
"Amit, our spirit artist. He might have drawn you blindfolded with utter accuracy, but now that he's seen you, he will have to draw someone else."
The Mountie chuckles.
"A shame. Take good care. You can find some rough types on board in the lower classes."
"We'll be most cautious."
"We're passing through the muskeg tonight, gentlemen. Best to keep your curtains closed."
"Indeed," says Mr. Dorian.
Will feels a lump in his throat and can't help looking back as Samuel Steele disappears from sight. With leaden footsteps, he follows Mr. Dorian to their compartment. As soon as the ringmaster has locked the door, Will whispers,
"Why didn't you want me to talk to him?"
"What's happened?"
asks Marin from the top bunk. She's in her nightdress. Even in his distress, Will notices how pretty she looks with her hair down.
"We passed Samuel Steele in the corridor," Mr. Dorian tells her.
"Don't you trust him?"
Will wants to know.
"You can't think he's in with Brogan."
"I'd trust Lieutenant Steele with my life. No, he's the most honorable of men. But if you'd gone to him, William, and poured out your story, Brogan would have been apprehended."
"But that's good,"
Will says, confused.
"And the funeral car would no doubt have been placed under very careful surveillance."
Mr. Dorian says nothing more, just watches Will patiently.
"You want the golden spike too?"
Will breathes in amazement. An amused smile twitches Mr. Dorian's lips.
"No. What I want is entirely different."
"But you do want something inside the funeral car?"
"Indeed."
"You want to rob the Boundless?"
"There's a painting I need."
"A painting?"
he exclaims.
"You expect me to believe that? Just a painting?"
"As an aspiring artist," Mr. Dorian replies wryly, "I'm surprised you don't have a higher opinion of the arts."
"Is it very valuable?"
"Some think it is. I offered Van Horn a small fortune for it years ago. If he'd sold it to me, I wouldn't need to steal it now."
Will has a sudden recollection of Mr. Dorian on the company train, talking to the rail baron.
"It's the same one?"
Will asks.
"The blacksmith shop?"
"Ah, you do remember. Van Horn loved that painting. Why, I'm not sure. I find it rather mediocre myself."
"Then why do you want it?"
"That's my business."
In astonishment, Will turns to Marin. When her eyes slide guiltily away, a sinkhole opens inside him. He swallows, his mouth dry.
"You knew about this?"
Slowly, she gives a nod. He looks back to Mr. Dorian.
"I thought you were protecting me."
"We are protecting you, Will,"
Marin says.
"But you're just using me."
Looking from her to Mr. Dorian, he feels hurt, and for the first time with them, frightened.
"My key. That's what you want, isn't it?"
Mr. Dorian sits down on the lower bunk and starts methodically unlacing his shoes.
"Not at all. I have my own key."
From a chain inside his jacket, the ringmaster produces a familiar-looking key and holds it out to Will.
"How?"
Will asks in amazement.
"It was in your father's pocket during our show. I simply took an impression in a block of clay and had my chief machinist make a copy."
Will plays the scene back in his mind. The audience was stupefied by the train's passage through time zones, or Mr. Dorian's mesmerism, or both. The ringmaster could easily have done many things invisibly.
"What do you want me for, then?"
he demands uneasily.
"All we need is your cooperation and silence," says Mr. Dorian. "Just two more nights, William. Then you'll be free to return to your father."
"Free?"
he says numbly.
"Which means I'm a prisoner now?"
"Perhaps I chose my words poorly," says Mr. Dorian. I hope you will see your way to helping us.
Help you? He says, anger suddenly steaming through him. Why should I help you? You're just a couple thieves!
William, you're tired, says the ringmaster.
Mr. Dorian is looking at him with his dark eyes, and Will does feel exceedingly tired. Last night he hardly got any sleep at all.
You've been going hard for a long time, says Mr. Dorian. Anyone would feel very, very tired.
Will wrenches his gaze away from the ringmaster. Don't hypnotize me, he says.
I'm saying you need rest, William, Mr. Dorian says. Rest is what you need more than anything else right now. If you just listen to me, listen to sense.
Will raises his voice to drown out the ringmaster's.
Brogan's trying to kill me! The longer I wait, the more chance he has of finding me!
Yes, and we've disguised you so Brogan won't find you. We took you in without asking you a single question and harbored you.
We'll protect you, Will, says Marin.
He can't meet her eye. He's been stupid. He thought she truly liked him, but she was just pretending so they could string him along like a puppy.
You can't protect me against a knife or a pistol, he scoffs.
You'll certainly make it much harder if you draw attention to yourself, Mr. Dorian says softly.
And what about my father?
He carries on.
Who's to say Brogan won't try to kill him?
Keep your voice down, Will,
Marin says sharply.
I've got to warn him now!
She looks ill at ease, but says nothing.
Mr. Dorian says, Your father is safe.
You can't know that. You probably don't even care.
2 nights, William. That's all I ask.
Mr. Dorian stands and walks to the door, blocking the exit. There is nothing menacing about his posture, but Will knows if he were to try to reach the door, Mr. Dorian would stop him. Will could never overpower him, and the thought fills him with fear. So he nods and says no more, but he already knows what he will do later tonight. Brogan shivers as he enters colonist class, glad of the heat but not the ripe stench. He makes his way to Peters's car and finds the Englishman stretched out on a cushioned bench reading the newspaper.
How's business? Says Brogan, eyeing the shelves, trying to judge how much trade Peters has done.
Bit slow today, says Mr. Peters.
I told you, you gouge too deep. You'll cut off your own leg.
You'll want your share, I dare say,
says Peters, stirring himself reluctantly and reaching under the bench for a strong box.
Keep it for now, Brogan says, as a down payment. You get the stuff I asked for earlier?
Ah, indeed I did.
From a shelf he takes down a small wooden box and then pries off the lid. Nestled in sand is a slim wooden vial. Brogan draws it out carefully, reads the label, then opens the vial and sniffs. Peters smirks.
An acceptable vintage?
Suits me just fine.
Brogan takes a pouch from his pocket, fills it with sand, and slips the vial inside.
You're very casual, sir, says Peters a little nervously.
When you've worked with this stuff as much as I have, you know what's allowed and what's not. And I think there was something else you said you could sell me.
Of course, says Peters.
From the counter, he takes a shallow case and opens it.
That's the stuff, says Brogan, reaching for the pistol.
Peters pulls it back.
Expensive things you're purchasing.
You'll get your payment. Don't you worry.
Before you blow yourself up is preferable to me.
One of Peters's guards clears his throat and taps his rifle butt against the floor. Brogan sniffs and pulls a small wad of bills from his pocket. He peels a few off and hands them to Peters.
I'm feeling generous.
Big plans, no doubt, says Peters.
Yep. You ain't seen that boy I told you about by any chance?
At this, Peters's eyes became more sly.
The red-headed boy?
Brogan looks at him hard.
That's the one.
I believe you said you'd pay for that information.
Gritting his teeth, Brogan peels off a couple more bills and hands them over.
You might want to take a look at the Indian boy traveling with Mr. Dorian.
Why would I want to do that?
Brogan's voice is hostile.
He's not who he says he is.
My men saw that kid when he was walking up the train.
Peters shrugs.
The porter, Drury, said he doesn't speak English, but one of my men overheard him talking, and he had $3 on him. Seems an awful lot for a circus brat.
I hope this ain't some goose chase, Peters.
You won't know unless you chase the goose.
In his guts, Brogan knows Peters might be right.
They still here?
Moved on to third class for the night.
I'm much obliged to you.
My pleasure. Do you plan on buying some bullets for that pistol?
In the middle bunk, Will waits, seething with anger and fear. Below him, Mr. Dorian snores softly. Above him, Marin is silent. The room is nearly pitch dark, except for the faintest moon glow coming from around the curtains. He's lost track of how long he's been waiting, but surely they must be asleep by now. What a fool he's been, to be taken in by these two. All those stories about circus folk being scoundrels, all true. Despite Mr. Dorian's fancy manners and clever tricks, he's just a common thief. And Marin, too. Didn't she steal his Sasquatch tooth? He wants to transform her into a villain, but he keeps seeing the lively-eyed girl he met 3 years ago in the mountains. Furious, he crumples the image up like a ruined drawing. He's got to get out of here. All he has to do is swing himself quietly off the bunk and make it to the door, and then he'll be free to run. He's worried about passing between cars. If the brakemen are still watching, he might be spotted. And what about passing between classes without his ticket? Surely the porters will believe his story. If he makes a ruckus, they'll at least drag him before Samuel Steele. Unless they're working for Brogan. But not everyone can be working for him. He takes a slow breath and tenses his muscles.
Well,
whispers Marin from the bunk above. He says nothing, just closes his eyes. He hears her shifting and knows she's leaning over the side, peering at him. She prods him in the shoulder.
I know you're awake.
He doesn't reply.
Don't go,
she says. He lies still. She pokes him in the eye.
Ow!
He gasps.
Sorry, did I get your eye?
Yes! He can see the shape of Marin's head, her hair spilling darkly down. Below them, Mr. Dorian stirs, but then resumes snoring softly.
I'm sorry,
she whispers.
I just meant to poke your head. I know you're planning on leaving.
What are you talking about?
If you go, Mr. Dorian won't be able to rob the funeral car.
You get it cut, I suppose?
Not really.
Will frowns. Not really? What does that mean?
I don't care about the painting. He just needs me to turn off the electricity.
Why can't he do it himself?
The keyhole's underneath the funeral car, and the train will be moving.
Moving? Her voice is unconcerned.
I can do it. I've been practicing.
He remembers her in the gymnasium, shimmying down the tightrope on her back. The image makes him queasy now.
Is he forcing you to do this? Not exactly.
How then? She sighs.
If I do it, he says he'll release me from my contract. My brother's too. And he'll pay me $5,000.
Will inhales sharply. That's a lot of money.
We'll be able to start up our own show. My whole family. My father's leg won't heal properly, ever. No one will ever hire him again. I need that money if we want to be together in one place. This is my chance to get free.
Still. Thieving. It ain't right. There's gotta be another way. Without noticing, he has fallen back into his old way of talking, words smacking together like shunted boxcars.
And what would you do for me, Will Everett? Are you going to rescue me?
Will blushes, glad it's dark. I wouldn't know how. It just doesn't seem right, you're risking your life.
I'm not worried.
No chains can bind you, no lock hold you.
That's right. Please, Will, stay.
He doesn't want to be swayed by her. He still doesn't trust her. He thought she liked him, but how can he know properly now? Yes, they're helping him, but they're also using him. And what kind of man would ask a girl to do something so dangerous, and all for a painting?
You'll stay with us?
Marin asks him.
Yes,
he says.
You're lying.
She's right, but he still doesn't trust her. For all he knows, she's invented her father's injury and her plans to start her own show. Maybe the painting is a lie, too, and they're really both after the gold spike.
I'm going to sleep, he says.
I'll stay up all night, watching you.
Suit yourself,
he says, and turns to face the wall. He has no intention of falling asleep. He'll wait her out, but he can no longer fight his exhaustion, and before long, he's fast asleep.
Guided by lantern light, Brogan, Mackey, and Chisholm make their sure-footed way, single file, atop the Boundless. On either side of the track stretches the Shield, a crust of ancient rock, broken only by huge swathes of bottomless muskeg. Wizened trees crouch, rocking like old crones, trying to stay warm against the cutting wind. The water glints restlessly, as though it wants to rise and spread. Brogan has seen this landscape in daylight and moonlight, in lightning and in blinding sun, and nothing improves it. It's the most godforsaken waste he can imagine.
We shouldn't be out here,
he hears Chisholm say behind him.
The hag!
Brogan glances back with a sneer.
What about the hag?
Chisholm's cheeks are sunken in shadow.
Just that they say she's more active in moonlight.
There ain't no hag, Brogan says. And if there is, I'll give her a thumping she won't forget. If you'd recognized that boy when you seen him, we wouldn't need to be out here at all.
Had that giant with him anyway,
says Chisholm.
Not anymore, says Brogan, turning.
If that half-breed magician thinks he can spirit away the boy, he's sadly mistaken. A bit of face paint might fool the likes of Chisholm, but Brogan will know if he sees him. He should have suspected something when Dorian called him by his real name back in the circus cars. Who'd told him that? If it was the boy, that meant he was still alive and on the train. And if he's on the train, he'll be in third class. There's not too many places they could put three circus performers for the night. They'll be sleeping by now, and the butt of Brogan's pistol will keep the ringmaster and the girl that way. And for the boy, nice and quiet, the knife. From the locomotive comes the long, hard blast of the whistle. There is no more urgent sound to a brakeman. Sudden stop.
Get back to your cars! Brogan shouts to Chisholm and Mackey.
Down the length of the Boundless, lantern lights flicker as men rush to the rooftops, hustling for the brake wheels. Another long, desperate whistle blast fills the night, and then another. It's an emergency. Maybe something up ahead blocking the tracks. As he bolts back to his own station, Brogan already feels the train slowing. He glances down and sees the water nearly at the tracks, and lapping higher still. He knows what's happened. Muskeg. Will dreams there is a woman standing at the foot of his bed, screaming. She looks directly at him, and with a quick jerk of her hand, drags the covers off his body. When he wakes, the screaming has become the frantic blast of a steam whistle and the shriek of brakes. His body presses hard against the bunk safety rail as the train comes to a nervous standstill. A tremor runs through her steel skin, like a horse eager to bolt. Beyond the walls of their tiny compartment, Will hears the rumblings of surprised passengers. A baby's thin-edged cry wells up from a distant berth. When he tries to sit up, he realizes he's been handcuffed to the bunk.
Hey!
He says, yanking against the manacles.
She's locked you up, Mr. Dorian says quietly from the darkness. No doubt for your own protection.
He's sitting on the bench and appears to be already dressed.
My own protection?
Will exclaims.
You were thinking of running, the ringmaster says. You might have been caught.
You can't keep me locked up!
William, your voice, please.
I could holler for help!
Mr. Dorian is suddenly beside the bunk, his face fierce in the shadows.
You could, but you won't. Because if you do, a porter will eventually come. Questions will be asked. While they're trying to figure out what to do with you, news will spread quickly through the brakemen. Before you even reach second class, Brogan will visit you and his knife will find a soft place between your ribs.
Will says nothing for a moment, breathing hard.
Why have we stopped?
I was just going to find out. There might have been an accident.
He thinks instantly of his father.
What kind of accident?
Stay here.
Will jangles the handcuffs defiantly. I can't go anywhere else, can I? Mr. Dorian slips out the door and closes it behind him.
Marin!
Will says, thumping the bottom of her bunk. She mumbles something that sounds like,
no,
and turns over, deep asleep. He kicks at the underside of her bunk and only succeeds in hurting his toes. Outside the door, he hears some footsteps, and then someone, maybe a porter, saying,
Part of the track's been flooded. They're working to lay new rails. Nothing to worry about. Shouldn't be too long. Used to this kind of thing.
Will twists himself around in the bunk and parts the curtains. The muskeg is barren, yet strangely beautiful in the moon's silver light. There is scrub and black spruce and darkly lustrous pools of water. Because the train tracks curve gently to the left, he can see the entire length of the boundless and far, far in the distance, the silhouette of the locomotive. It's like a small mountain on the flat horizon. Pinpricks of light twinkle from the cab. It looks undamaged. His father is most likely fine. In that moment, he feels an almost smothering sense of longing. It's a big distance, but he could run it. He wouldn't have to bother with porters and passports. He could just run along open ground right to the locomotive. He could jump aboard and be with his father, and he would have rescued himself without anyone's help. With a gasp, he spots a woman standing at the side of the track, looking in at him. Their eyes meet. A chill sweeps over Will's body, and he realizes she's the woman from his dream. He lets the curtains fall back, presses his hand against them, as if he can erase what he's just seen.
What have I done? What have I done?
He blinks, trying to flush the image from his mind, but he can't. A wind blows outside the carriage, carrying with it the faint whinny of horses and the rusty moan of cattle. Will doesn't want to turn his head, because he is afraid. No, he is certain that there is someone beside him on the bunk. In vain, he tries to trace the wavery lines of the curtains, but his eyes won't cooperate. They want to slide away. He feels his head turning, as though some brutish schoolmaster has a hand on his skull. She is crouched beside him, her limbs unnaturally folded, looking at him in terrible ecstasy. He wants to scream, but his terror is bottled inside him like in a nightmare, and the only sound he hears from himself is a dull grunt. The hag reaches out and touches his handcuffs. They spring open.
You wanted an adventure,
she says without speaking. His heart races. Yes.
Come have an adventure, then. You can run to the locomotive. You can be with your father.
His legs swing themselves over the bunk, and he slides down to the floor, trembling like a marionette. In his long johns and vest, he jerks over to the door, opens it, and steps into the corridor. He stares straight ahead. He doesn't need to turn his head to know she's right there beside him, tied to him like a shadow. He can feel her claw-like grip on his forearm. In another moment, he has reached the door to the car. There's no porter here, and he steps outside onto the platform. Four steps take him down to the side. Thick, murky water laps against the rail bed like an oily tide.
Just look, she says inside his head. The locomotive's so close.
He starts toward it. If he can only keep his eyes fixed on the smokestack and not look at the woman beside him, he will get there. But his route is taking him away from the track, and he splashes into the wet muck. It flows over his feet. He doesn't notice until it's up to his ankles.
Keep going,
the voice in his ear tells him helpfully.
The shortest distance between two points is a straight line.
The bottom is mossy, sucking at his feet as he lifts them with each slow step. He keeps going, up to his knees now. The cold clench of water moves up his thighs. Then the bottom drops away and he flounders up to his neck.
Help!
He cries from his wordless mouth. He lifts his chin high, trying to tread water without swallowing any. He flails out for something firm, but every bit of earth dissolves instantly the moment he touches it. He kicks out, trying to find purchase, The water sucks at him hungrily, and he knows it isn't normal water. It wants to pull him under. It wants to fill his lungs. Not 5 feet away, there is a blighted tree, and he thrashes toward it, spluttering, getting nowhere. The muskeg hag is crouched there amongst the gnarled roots. He knows he will never reach that tree.
"Are you enjoying your adventure?"
she asks soundlessly. She is close enough so that she could reach out a hand and pull him up. Her face is expressionless. She sits watching as he sinks deeper.
"Gently," she says. "Go ahead. Breathe."
He can barely lift his arms through the dense muck. She smiles, her eyes dead.
"It's all right. Just take a deep breath."
He goes under.
"Breathe."
He fights against the urge to fill his lungs. Something pokes him hard in the side of the head, and then again, and he feels roused from a sleep. Terror pours through him. Sluggishly, he lifts his hand to protect his head, but is poked again in the shoulder. He closes his hand around the thing and feels it give a tug. Instinctively, he grasps it with both hands. Dragged upward, his head breaks free. He gulps air. He sees Marin at the other end of her long tightrope wire, his pair of muskeg spectacles over her eyes. She pulls and reels him in with all she's worth. He kicks toward her.
"Don't look back!" she shouts.
"Look back."
He starts to turn.
"Look at me, William."
"Look at me, Will!"
Marin calls, and he keeps his eyes on her, as intent as if he were drawing her. Before long, her hands are gripping him and tugging, and he lurches out of the muskeg. She is panting and crying a little, too. She turns her back to the muskeg hag and hurries Will toward the train. His legs have both gone to sleep, and he can barely feel them.
"Let's get you inside," she says. "Your makeup's half washed off."
"Thank you," he wheezes. He's startled by how far they are from the train. He stamps his feet against the earth, trying to batter feeling into them, and then he sees three figures walking toward them.
"Hey!" Brogan shouts out. "What are you doing out here?"
"Who are they?"
Mackie says.
"I can't see them,"
Chisholm replies, squinting his buggy eyes at the two figures staggering out of the muskeg. Brogan lifts his lantern, trying to catch them with his light. One of them is a girl, and the other one's leaning on her. A boy, he thinks, but can't be sure because his head is down. Who'd be stupid enough to wander out here? Unless they were making a run for it. Brogan finds the knife in his pocket and grips it tight. Suddenly, the two figures start hobbling for the train, fast as they can.
"Get 'em!"
Brogan barks, and they give chase. It's dark, his lantern light jangling around all over the mushy earth. The moon disappears behind cloud, and Brogan trips on something and goes down. The lantern is dashed from his hands and extinguished. Blind for a moment, he pushes himself up and thinks he sees a woman's face, cheek pressed to the mud, smiling at him. Can't be right. Just a shadow. And now the moon's back out, and he's on his feet again, and the boy is right in front of him. It's him. William Everett.
"There he is. Couldn't have asked for more."
Brogan tackles him, and they both go down into 2 feet of muck and water.
"You can drown him nice and quietly," the voice says inside his head.
"Brogan!"
the boy is shouting.
"Brogan, stop!"
He's thrashing hard, the boy dragging both of them deeper into the bog. Brogan tries to stand and feels his feet sink. He steadies himself, punches the boy in the face, gets his hands round his throat and pushes. The boy's head goes under, comes back up gasping, and Brogan pushes it down again, this time for good.
"There you go," she says inside his head. "Hold him down."
"Brogan!"
someone is shouting beside him. It's Mackie.
"Brogan! Let him up! That's Chisholm!"
"Just run,"
Marin hisses. Will takes a last backward glance at Brogan, struggling with one of his own men in the bog. What happened? A third man, maybe Mackie, is hollering from the shadows, trying to pull them both back to solid ground. Then Will looks straight ahead and forces his numb legs to carry him as swiftly as possible toward the boundless. Chapter 11. The World of Wonders. Mr. Dorian is waiting for them at the door to their carriage, and hurriedly ushers them inside.
"Thank goodness," he says with obvious relief. "I was just about to go looking."
Will is sodden and shivering and covered in bog mud. There are a few other people in the corridor, and he hangs his head so they won't see his washed-away face.
"Just a little stroll in the muskeg," Mr. Dorian says to the curious.
Inside their compartment, the ringmaster locks the door.
"What happened?"
"I can't believe I opened the curtains," Will mutters.
"I woke up," says Marin, "and you were gone, and I saw the handcuffs on the floor. When I looked out the window, you were there, and there was just something about the way you were walking, like sleepwalking. It wasn't normal. So I put on those glasses of yours and hurried out."
"Well done, Marin," the ringmaster says.
"You saw her, didn't you?"
Will asks her.
"It's all shadow through the spectacles, but there was definitely someone with you. She moved around a lot. Sometimes it was like her feet weren't even touching the ground."
"She came right inside," Will says.
He points to the handcuffs on the floor.
"She took those off. What is she?"
Mr. Dorian takes a breath.
"That I don't know. What she does is quite beyond my understanding or abilities. The world is full of wonders, especially along this road."
"Brogan and some of his men were out there too," Marin
tells the ringmaster. Mr. Dorian turns intently to Will.
"Did they recognize you?"
"I don't know. He was shouting at us. We just started running."
"I thought we were finished," Marin says, "because you were really slow at first, but then suddenly Brogan tackled one of his own men. It looked like he was trying to drown him."
"He must have seen the hag," Will says. "She puts ideas into your head."
"Maybe he thought it was you," says Marin.
Will shivers at the thought.
"You'll want to get out of those wet clothes," Mr. Dorian tells him.
"I'm sorry,"
he mumbles, for the underclothes have a rich stink to them. He still feels dislocated from his body, like all the sensation hasn't quite returned to his limbs. He starts peeling off the soaking garments, then glances awkwardly over at Marin.
"I won't look," she says, turning. "Here, I'll set out your dry clothes on the bunk."
"I'll take these to the washroom to clean them,"
says Mr. Dorian, pushing the filthy clothes into a burlap sack and leaving the room. Gratefully, Will dries himself with a small towel and pulls on clean trousers and a shirt. Marin is going through her bag.
"Madame Lemoine gave me some extra paint for touch-ups."
She produces several small jars and a brush. Will sits on the bench, and Marin kneels before him.
"Can you fix it?"
Will asks.
"It won't be nearly as good as what Madame Lemoine did, but I'll try."
Staring at him intently, she brushes paint over his cheekbones. She bites her lower lip as she works. Will knows she's just concentrating, but he still feels embarrassed to be the subject of such attention from her. He gazes at the floor, though keeps sneaking small peeks at her face. Her eyes unexpectedly meet his.
"You handcuffed me to the bunk," he says.
"I just saved your life. You turned me into a prisoner."
He's still angry with her, but can't quite muster the same outrage he felt earlier.
"I knew you'd run, so I manacled you."
Mr. Dorian returns and locks the cabin door behind him. He's carrying two steaming mugs.
"Hot chocolate,"
he says, handing them to Marin and Will.
"Your clothes are hanging up to dry in the washroom."
"Thank you,"
Will says.
"Is the train all right?"
"Quite all right. I made inquiries. A sinkhole opened up beneath the tracks, but they're working hard to fill it up with sand and gravel."
"Will we be able to get through?"
"The Boundless carries extra steel for just such eventualities."
"No one was hurt up front?"
he asks, thinking of his father. Mr. Dorian shakes his head. Will takes a sip of his hot chocolate. It's just the right sweetness and very creamy. He still isn't sure how to speak to Mr. Dorian. Is he a friend or a prison warden?
"Are you going to handcuff me again?"
"That depends. Can we trust you?"
"Trust me? I'm not the thief."
"I have my reasons for being one," says the ringmaster.
"What's so special about this painting?"
"Quite simply, I can't live without it."
Will gives a sniff of laughter, but then sees the serious expression on Mr. Dorian's face. The ringmaster looks from Will to Marin.
You have a right to know. You especially, Marin, since you're helping me. I am the inheritor of a family curse. Medical in nature, not magical. My great-grandfather, a man of immense strength and vigor, died at the age of 39. My grandfather died at the same age. As did my own father. All three were felled by a sudden and massive seizure of the heart. I am 2 weeks away from my 39th birthday. Looking at Mr. Dorian, Will finds it almost impossible to believe that he could suffer from any illness.
Have you seen a doctor?
He asks. Many. And all say the same thing. I have some tragic flaw in my heart. There is nothing to be done about it. It is a clock that will eventually trip over itself and stop. Will isn't sure what any of this has to do with stealing a painting. Given my parentage, carving out a life for myself was no easy thing, Mr. Dorian says. But I did it. I built my circus into one of the finest in the world. But there is still too much I want to do. Too much left to achieve. I will not be snuffed out in my prime.
But you can't know it'll happen to you too, Marin says.
Mr. Dorian gives a dry chuckle. The history is not promising. But I mean to thwart it.
How?
Will asks, glancing at Marin. She looks just as confused as he feels.
You've heard the legend of the Fountain of Youth, yes?
Will nods.
But listen a moment. The Arawak people of the West Indies told the first Spanish settlers about it. There are many accounts of a natural spring in Florida that bestowed permanent youth. A Spaniard called Juan Ponce de León found it. But he left no written record. I spent years searching for that fountain.
But I thought you didn't believe in magic,
Will says.
I don't. Why is it any more magical than the Sasquatch or the muskeg hag? You've beheld both with your own eyes. There's no magic about these things. We may not understand them yet, but they're part of our world, and anything that exists in the world is real.
Did you find it?
Marin asks.
The sight only. The pool had long ago dried up. But I did learn that an enterprising fellow had devised a way of secretly transporting the water. He soaked up the last of it with fabric, and divided that fabric into a number of canvases. And it turned out that if you painted someone's portrait upon the canvas, that person remained young, and only his picture aged.
Will says,
This... it can't be true.
Time is a mysterious thing. You've seen how it can falter when we cross a time zone. This water simply helps time forget itself. Beyond that, I have no understanding of the water's properties.
Apparently one of the canvases made its way to England, where it's been keeping a very unpleasant fellow young for many years. Another went to Persia, another still to a Russian prince. One found its way to our shores and fell into the hands of a painter, one Cornelius Krieghoff. He painted a blacksmith shop on it. Clearly, he had no idea.
Nor did Van Horn.
There have been moments, and Will remembers each one, when he has sensed his life shift. He felt it that day in the mountains when he met Marin for the first time, and he feels it again now. The entire world seems much larger and stranger than he could ever have imagined. It now contains not only Sasquatch, but a muskeg hag, and canvases that can trick time itself. He certainly doesn't understand it, and he's not even sure he believes it.
I need that painting, says Mr. Dorian, and I happen to know it's inside Van Horn's funeral car. It's just hanging unseen like a relic in an Egyptian pharaoh's tomb. I want my portrait painted on the back. From that moment on, my body will not age. My heart's clock will not snap its spring, and that, William Everett, is my story. What do you say? Am I a villain?
Will thinks carefully. It's still stealing, but it's hard to care very much when it's something that otherwise is just going to hang in the darkness forever. Why leave it there when it could save a man's life? And yet...
Getting Marin to crawl underneath,
he says hesitantly.
You shouldn't. It's not right to ask her to do something so dangerous.
Mr. Dorian smiles.
Your chivalry is a credit to you, William. But I think Maron has made her own decision.
Yes, she says, surprising Will with the annoyance in her voice. And please don't bring it up again.
He frowns.
All right.
It's bad luck having someone around who doesn't think you can do something, she says. Hands.
He stretches out his hands so she can reapply more skin paint.
I think you can do it, he says as she roughly brushes makeup on. But that just turns the power off. Do you even know where the door is?
Of course, says Dorian. It's in the right side, 10 feet back from the front of the car.
Will tries to conjure it before his mind's eye. He saw it only briefly that day in the junction. He was in such a hurry to find Maron. He remembers his eyes getting lost in the complicated contours of the decorations. All those sculpted metal wreaths and garlands and ivy and blossoms and fruit. He supposes the door must be hidden there.
And if you get the painting, who'll do your portrait?
Madame Lemoine, says Mr. Dorian. She's got quite a fine hand.
Ah, says Will, disappointed somehow.
The car gives a little forward jerk, and then another longer pull.
There we go, says the ringmaster. We're on our way again.
What about Brogan and his men? Will says. They must have been looking for me. Why else were they out there?
I hope they all drowned, Maron mutters.
I doubt that, says Mr. Dorian. But I'm hopeful they might not have seen you properly. In any event, there are too many people up and about tonight for them to try anything. Our door is locked, and I have no need of more sleep. I hope you're not thinking of running again, William.
Will lets out a deep breath. Twice they've saved his life, and that counts for a lot. Even if he wanted to run, he doesn't have an ounce of energy left.
I'm not going anywhere,
he says, and is rewarded with a smile from Maron.
Good.
From his breast pocket, Mr. Dorian takes one of the native tools Will saw mounted on his stateroom wall.
What is that?
Will asks uneasily.
A Cree hide scraper. Tricks can be useful, but I've often found this can be equally persuasive.
He rests the wickedly sharp metal blade on his lap and turns to face the door.
Are you standing guard because of Brogan? Or because of me?
Will asks.
Mr. Dorian glances back with a smile. You should try to get a little more sleep before daybreak. Both of you.
We have a performance at noon.
Chapter 12. In the Saloon. Will sleeps late, and when he wakes, Maron is already dressed, sitting cross-legged on the floor and looking out the window.
Where's Mr. Dorian?
He asks.
He's gone to get us some breakfast. He doesn't want us walking around.
Outside the window, trees flash past, their leaves bright with the morning sun. The Boundless has left the Muskeg behind. Will sees farmland, enclosed with rough fences, mist still pooled in the low fields. There's a house and barn in the distance, a horse in a pasture. From his bunk, he pulls his trousers and shirt from a peg. He dresses under the covers.
Do you think it's true?
He asks.
The canvas? I don't know. He knows so much about so many things. Nothing tricks him. He knows all the tricks.
She shakes her head.
If he thinks the Fountain of Youth is real, it must be.
How well do you know him?
Not well. I don't think anyone does. He's charming when he wants, fiercer than he needs to be sometimes.
Is he a good man?
Will says hopefully.
Well, he runs a good circus. No one's better at finding talent and putting together new attractions. He's got the best show in the Dominion, and he wants to be the best in the world. Some people think he's a slave driver, because he gets people to sign contracts for a long time.
Like yours?
She nods.
He pays pretty well, and treats the Marvels pretty well, but he keeps most of the money they bring in. I heard he had a pretty hard life growing up.
Because he's Métis, Will says.
He hardly talks about it, but I think something bad might have happened to his mother. That's about all I know. He's a mystery. Like everyone, I guess.
It's just...
Will shakes his head, searches for the right words.
Why should he get his portrait on that canvas? Why not the sick boy in colonist class?
Why not you? Why does he deserve it? They say the world's full of saints, and I'm pretty sure he's not one of them.
He looks at the door to their compartment. No one's guarding it right now.
Still deciding whether to help him?
Marin asks. Will sighs.
I'm not sure about him, but I want to help you.
You'll stay?
I'll stay.
Will feels his face heat up in the glow of her smile. She takes her remarkable spool of tightrope from the shelf and brushes some dried muskeg muck off it.
Why'd you bring it with you last night?
He asks.
It's kind of a habit. You'll think it's silly, but just having it with me makes me feel better. Like I can get out of any scrape.
That doesn't sound silly, he says. It makes complete sense to me.
I have a dream sometimes that I'm crossing a big space on my wire.
Niagara Falls?
Will asks.
Maybe. And I'm halfway across, and there's water beneath me, mist churning. I'm so far from land, I can't even see either shore.
Is it scary?
Not at first. It always starts off peaceful. But then I don't know which way I'm supposed to go.
If it were my dream, I'd probably fall, Will says.
Oh, I have those too. Anyway, my spool comes with me everywhere. Just like your pencil, I suppose.
Will laughs in surprise.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts, well, they float free when my hand and eyes are busy. It helps me think things through. Also, I love it.
I can tell.
It's fun when you get to certain parts.
Like what?
Oh, I don't know. There's parts you just know are going to be fun. Like a curtain with all the folds and shadows. I love those too.
It seems like it'd be hard.
He laughs.
Not as hard as wire walking.
When I'm up there, I feel like I can do anything.
Well, Will says, I'm not that good a drawer yet, but I want to be.
He thinks of the conversation he had with his father on the first night.
My father wants me to join the company as a clerk.
Is that what you want?
Well, I was thinking, if I worked for the railway, I could maybe make things better for the colonists. Get rid of people like Peters.
That would be good,
Marin agrees.
And I might be able to help design things,
Will tells her. Bridges and ships, maybe.
I'm sure you'd be good at it.
It'd be a good job, Will says.
Yeah. You don't really want to do it, do you?
No. There's an art school in San Francisco I want to go to.
So why don't you?
My father doesn't want to pay. She sniffs.
You could work. Pay your own way. I was working from the age of 5.
He feels childish. Even when he was poor, Will never had to work. Those years when it was just him and his mother, he took care of himself and ran errands and chopped wood and pumped water and helped wash and clean, but he never worked. Plenty of kids did, in factories or workshops. He was spared that anyway. It sounded hard to make money on your own.
Maybe I'm not suited for a hard life, he says. That's what my father thinks.
Do you believe that?
He shrugs.
If Mr. Dorian hadn't taken me in, Brogan would have killed me. I got hagged. I didn't even remember to put those muskeg spectacles on. I would have drowned if it weren't for you.
You're looking at it the wrong way around,
she says.
You got free of Brogan. You ran the deck of the Boundless at night. That's something.
He nods and smiles a little.
I like your way of looking at things better.
So you should go to this art school of yours.
When Will opens the door to the saloon car, noise pours over him like a cascade of poker chips. A song peals from the upright piano in the corner, nearly obliterated by the laughter and stamping of the patrons. A high wooden bar runs almost the entire length of the carriage. Men perch atop stools, their boots on the brass foot rail, drinking and jetting their tobacco juice into spittoons. Behind the bar, the wall is a long stretch of mirror, reflecting the room back at itself, so it seems even bigger and more crowded. A pair of stuffed pheasants stands startled atop the counter. The antlered head of an elk watches solemnly over the gambling tables. Gusting through the maelstrom of smells, stale beer, cigar smoke, sweaty leather, is the scent of women's perfume, something Will hasn't smelled since his first night aboard the train. But this fragrance is totally unlike the pale scents he's used to sniffing in drawing rooms and on his mother. This smell is big and loud, to match the colorful pleated dresses he sees on the women serving tables or dancing with the men. The dancing seems all the more raucous because of the general rocking and rolling of the train. Everyone lurches and reels. The saloon is a double-decker car, and on the second level, men stand against the railing with their drinks, watching the dancers and the card tables. Doors lead into small rooms, and Will spots a man being led into one by a woman with bare shoulders. He catches Marin looking at him and blushes. Their porter ushers them over to the middle of the saloon. Against a wall, they've made a small platform out of whiskey crates and hung a curtain across it, so there's a little backstage area for the performers.
"I hope this is all right," the porter says.
"I'm sure we'll have their undivided attention," Mr. Dorian replies dryly.
"Oh, they've come to see you," the porter says. "That's why it's so crowded."
At one of the card tables, a man stands up with a whoop of glee and a fistful of cash. Immediately, one of the other men launches himself at the winner, and they tumble about on the floor, beating each other. Behind the barkeep takes a sledgehammer from its brackets on the wall and slams it loudly onto the counter. Quickly, the fight breaks up, and several men limp away, bloodied.
"Well, I'm looking forward to this," Marin says as the porter swiftly departs.
"Shall we prepare?"
Mr. Dorian says, ushering Will and Marin behind the curtain. Hidden from the saloon, Will removes his coat and thinks,
"After this, just two more performances, and then I'm back in first class."
But another part of him surges with nerves and excitement for the show. They arrange their props carefully. Removing his jacket, Mr. Dorian suddenly winces, his face pale, but then he takes a breath and stands taller.
"Are you all right?"
Will asks. Without a word, the ringmaster steps through the gap in the curtain. Will and Marin put their faces to the opening. He's aware of the faint metallic mustiness of her jeweled costume, but also the gentler fragrance of soap and skin and hair that seems such an innocent smell in the saloon's oppressive beeriness. Mr. Dorian stands on the makeshift stage, saying nothing. Somehow, his mere presence quiets the crowd. The noise ebbs like a gale that has blown itself out. Silently, methodically, Mr. Dorian rolls back his sleeves to the elbows. Will has no idea what the ringmaster will do. He doesn't discuss it ahead of time. So Will is just as curious as everyone else. Mr. Dorian lifts his arms into the air, fingers spread. Then he closes his hands, and when he opens them again, he's holding a card in each one, between thumb and first finger. Will can see they're both the two of hearts. A few grunts and whispers rumble across the saloon.
"Our granny does it better,"
someone sneers. Behind the curtain, Will whispers to Marin,
"They don't seem too impressed."
"Just wait."
"What's he going to do?"
"You'll see."
Mr. Dorian holds the cards aloft, turning them from side to side, showing the crowd they are just single cards he holds, no more. With a flick of his wrists, a three of hearts is added to each hand. There are a few grunts of appreciation and a smattering of tepid applause. Mr. Dorian stamps his foot against the crate floor, as though reprimanding them for their disbelief, and a third card appears in each of his hands. Very slowly, he waves his arms in the air like entranced snakes, closer together, farther apart. And more cards keep appearing in his hands. A five of hearts, a six, a seven. And he is moving faster, stamping time with his heels like a flamenco dancer, the cards forming fans. The room is totally silent now, except for the furious beat of Mr. Dorian's heels. Even the poker games have come to a standstill, all the card sharps staring in frank admiration. A jack of hearts, a queen, a king. Mr. Dorian's arms flash in the air in ever more intricate patterns, and then, with a flourish, an ace of hearts appears in each hand, completing the full suit. The room bursts into applause, but Mr. Dorian isn't done yet. He throws his two sets of cards into the air, and they fan out in slow intersecting arcs, shuffling themselves in mid-air. The ringmaster stands observant, hands uplifted as if conducting them, urging them on as they spiral about one another.
Enough!
He shouts to them, and they cascade back into his hands. He combines them into a single pile and starts to put them back into his trouser pocket. Then he changes his mind and hurls the cards into the audience, but they become 2 dozen white pigeons that soar up to the ceiling and disappear through the high windows. The applause is redoubled, with floor stamping and whistling.
Gentlemen and ladies, I am Mr. Dorian, and this is Zirkus Dante.
He has them now, completely, as he effortlessly takes them through several more feats and wonders. He hypnotizes a few members of the audience. He turns a man's hair into a bat and returns it to his head. He walks up 6 invisible steps. Through the fog of cigarette and cigar smoke, Will sees a man shoulder his way to the bar. He throws a bill onto the counter and points at a bottle on the shelf. Will's entire body tenses. Drink in hand, Brogan turns and watches Mr. Dorian.
He didn't drown,
Marin whispers before Will can say a word. And then to a great surge of applause, Mr. Dorian steps back behind the curtain.
Brogan's in the crowd,
Will tells him.
Should we keep Will back?
Marin asks the ringmaster.
He may leave before you go on, he tells Will. If not, we'll keep you back.
Mr. Dorian steps out to introduce Marin and help her rig her tightrope between the mezzanine railings. Wolf whistles rise up from the crowd.
Will stares at Brogan, who's got his back to the bar.
Beer in hand, he is watching Marin as she hops onto the tightrope. He looks pretty comfortable. Will doesn't see him leaving any time soon. When Marin finishes her first act and comes backstage, Brogan is still there, a fresh drink in hand.
We'll go straight to the finale,
Mr. Dorian tells them. He steps out before the audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, to conclude our performance, I welcome the miraculous Marin once more.
Marin is about to make her entrance when, from the audience, someone cries,
Little Sultan!
The breath catches in Will's throat.
Where's the little Sultan?
Calls someone else.
The brown boy who draws.
We went to see the little Sultan!
Someone must have spread the word about you,
breathes Marin.
I want me portrait done!
A woman with a terrifyingly loud voice shouts. Mr. Dorian steps back behind the curtain and looks at Will.
There is nothing to be done. Will you go out?
Will's throat is dry. He nods. He walks out to a cheer that does not seem altogether well-meaning. He avoids looking at Brogan, but is aware of him staring his way, a hot spot in Will's peripheral vision. After bowing, he turns his back on the audience. As Mr. Dorian makes his introductions, Marin appears with the scarf. The first volunteer is selected. Seated on the stool, eyes covered, Will begins to draw the image reflected in Marin's sequins. His mind feels scattered, and his hand shakes. The drawing is a clumsy one, but Mr. Dorian whisks it away after the customary minute and holds it up for the audience and the subject. With relief, Will hears the man say,
Ain't half bad. A brown boy's got a gift.
Another cheer rises from the audience, this one sounding more genuine.
He's making asses of you all, says a voice from the crowd.
Will does not need to see the speaker to know it's Brogan.
Is there a problem, good sir? Mr. Dorian asks.
None of this sir nonsense, Mr. Dorian.
His voice is getting closer.
You and me, we're old friends, ain't we, Mr. Dorian?
Reflected in Marin's sequins, Will blurrily sees Brogan moving through the crowd toward the stage. He sits rigidly, trying to control his breathing. He wants to bolt.
He killed the guard. He could kill me.
I got myself a feeling this boy of yours is a fraud, Mr. Dorian.
I assure you, sir, Amit is nothing of the sort.
I'd like a portrait done, then.
Very well, sir. I always enjoy making a believer from a non-believer. If you would stand here—
No, no,
Brogan says, and Will sees him pulling a black scarf from his neck.
Use this!
There is a taut silence in the room, like a storm about to break.
Why doesn't the bartender do anything? And why doesn't Samuel Steele come on his rounds?
If you have any doubts, Mr. Dorian says, you are free to tie our scarf around your own face.
No, there's some trick to it. That don't fool me.